State affairs will come to order. Senator Miller, Senator Ward, and myself, Senator Green, are present today. We have three items on the agenda, and the first of those is Senate Bill 348, after which we'll hear HB 449, and when Senator Lehman gets out of his current meeting, Senate Bill 287. Senator Ward will be presenting the information on this bill today. If you go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What this bill does, Senate Bill 348, it is to put in to a written form exactly what most people think is already their right under the Constitution, as well as their rights of privacy combined. And that is that we've come into a situation where there are certain procedures throughout time that people of authority have tried to have people have to do it regardless of what their conscience may say. And one of these is, which is the taking off point of this, is a person that has to participate in, at the current law, participate in taking of and performing an abortion, even though their conscience tells them that they think that this is wrong and this is murder. And then if, in fact, there become some laws like in Oregon where when people become too old, they pass some laws to end their lives too. And if somebody is really opposed to taking a life, what this does, this takes away their right to happiness and to pursue their course of job employment. And what this bill does, this puts into effect what we all thought was already there anyway, and that is the right to conscience. And I think just as much as during the massacre in Vietnam when certain soldiers didn't shoot unarmed people because of their choice of conscience, this does exactly the same thing. And we should not, as a society, be imposing these kinds of rules and laws on people against what their true beliefs are. And what this is just clarifies it and cleans up a little language. I kind of refer to this as just a technical amendment to what we all thought was already there anyway, and I don't think there'll be too much opposition to it. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You could probably just pass it out without any further testimony.
Madam Chairman, I...
Just kidding.
I know that we have a committee substitute.
Oh, excuse me.
That's true. That is true.
Yes. Madam Chairman, I thank you very much. I'd like to make a motion to approve the committee substitute for Senate Bill 348.
Version B.
Yes.
Objection? Seeing no objection, Cook version B is adopted as a working document. The questions of Senator Ward?
This is just statutory implementation. It's difficult to put down myself.
Technical stuff is just fine.
Yeah, I do have a couple questions.
Go ahead, Senator Griffin.
I was going to wait until other people testified, but I'll ask. Is there a constitutional amendment that goes along with this?
Madam Chairman, there is a constitutional amendment, SJR 35, which was introduced by myself, which in fact will be in Senate Finance tomorrow, which would implement, essentially overturn the validization but that's the constitutional amendment. Yes, there is.
So the referrals on this, this is your amendments in Finance has gone through Judiciary?
Yes, yes.
And this has another referral to Judiciary? Subsequent referral?
Yes, subsequent referral to Judiciary.
And the idea is to match those two up before they come to the floor?
I don't know if they will necessarily, through the chairman, I'm sure. I do not know if they will not necessarily be on the floor on the same day. No, I can't say that.
But without a constitutional amendment, this does nothing? Is that correct, Senator Ward?
Well, actually, we need the constitutional amendment to make it further clarified, but and I'm pretty comfortable that they're both going to pass this session.
Well,
I would hope they would. That would make it very crystal clear. But it's not necessary.
Actually, Madam Chairman, I think that this deals more with the individual, where
yes.
The Constitution, it deals more with the institutions.
It is
a difference.
Well, maybe someone could speak to that when they testified, and as to whether this bill does anything without a constitutional amendment.
My understanding is it does, but it certainly would make it better if both of them passed,
yeah.
And
someone from law going to be here, or someone?
Someone from law here. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go ahead, and we do have some folks on teleconference whom we will get to. I'll go ahead and take testimony. Janet, I think I'll let the departments testify first, and then we'll follow up with yours. Okay, Dr. Nakamura?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Peter Nakamura. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health for the state of Alaska. A bit of a disadvantage in that I haven't seen the CS for this bill, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to see if there are any changes. No, there are none.
Okay. Thank you. We'll get you one.
Sure. Thank you. I'd like to first comment that this is National Public Health Week. And I hope you all take advantage of this week to look after your own health and get your blood pressure down, get your blood pressures taken. But, you know, there are some things in public health that we know we don't know the answers to. Last night I had a chance of watching a program on progeria, and I don't know if any of you had a chance to see that. It's an amazing disease. There are, 26 or 27 people that have it between Canada and the United States, and they age so rapidly that by the time they're 10, they're probably at the end of their life with arthritis, heart disease, strokes, and it's the oldest, I think, has ever lived to 13. We don't know the answer to some of these problems we're trying. But there are some things that we definitely know work, and one of those things happens to be immunizations, the basic public health issue. If we didn't have a program in place now that mandated immunizations for entry to school, we would expect a good 25,000 children struck down every year by meningococcal disease. We'd see 4 million kids with measles. We'd see about 3 million of those dead. Pretty much every one of those diseases we know we can prevent. Seems like it has nothing to do with this, but basically it really does, because for the 7 years I've been here as the director of health, about 5 of those years, almost annually, I'm up here testifying about ways in which we can preserve immunizations for our kids. It so happens that there are actually some physicians out there who don't believe in immunizations. And if one of these physicians happened to be practicing in a community in Alaska, and decided that they didn't want, it was through their personal beliefs, they didn't want to immunize kids. Basically, those of us who have resources and ways of accessing health care would have no problems. We'd just hop a plane, we'd hop a train, we'd hop a bus, whatever we need to go out and get the immunizations and make sure that our kids are protected. But it's those people who don't have the resources, the poor, and those without the ability to gain these services that are going to be hurt every time we put another barrier to access to a positive public health service. Prior to coming here, I worked on the Navajo reservation where I ran the health care for the Navajo people. And early when we set up the health care system out there, it was not uncommon for those of us who were practicing care to turn around and find no nurse, no one out there working with us, because the Navajos had such strong feelings about death. If anyone died, they would burn the hogan, they would abandon the hogan. And in the same manner, a lot of the healthcare workers who didn't want to be associated with death would disappear if a person was sick enough or they felt that this patient was going to die. Now, if we followed a policy such as that proposed in this bill, we probably would have a hospital there that would not take care of people who were seriously ill, because there's a danger that they would die, and these individuals would be exposed to that. Well, the federal government built a hospital. They brought the staff in, and they felt that the purpose for being there was to provide health care. So rather than let that serve all the services for the critical and seriously ill be eliminated to meet an individual's conscience, these services were preserved. So I guess basically, in terms of the bill as I read it, I would, as a public health professional and as a physician, I would strongly object to another barrier to access to another service or any service that's so critical to these poor who would have no other alternatives.
Senator Miller.
Thank you. I thank you for your testimony, Doctor, but however, you've strayed considerably. All through this bill, it addresses abortion. So let's get back to the bill. Essentially,
if you believe that an individual
should not have, if a doctor, if through his moral or conviction, does not want to participate in abortion, which is the bill says that should be the standard, you know, moral or you know, you think, well, tough. If you're a doctor, that's tough. But, you know, that was fine with all the little things, you know, shots and everything else, but the bill refers to abortions.
If the bill specifically refers to abortions, and I interpret this to be more general than just abortions, but if it refers to abortions, if the facility is built with federal dollars, if the federal dollars are paying for the maintenance of that service, it seems that the broad range of services should be available. If an individual, by conscience, feels they don't want to participate, then the facility should make some options to make sure that those services would still be available, rather than making an individual not wanting to participate in something they don't want to. Now, the bill I read referred both to facilities as well as the individual's conscience. And if the bill I read said that if you happen to be a manager of a hospital, the owner of a hospital, if you happen to be on the board of a hospital, if you happen to even be a stockholder, and you so chose not to provide those services, you could do that. Now, if you build that facility with your own private funds, I can see where you would have that right.
Yes, Senator Miller.
And probably on that section, following up on Senator Duncan, I think probably the Department of Law could correct me, probably the constitutional amendment with the recent Valley decision probably is needed in order to enforce that section. But certainly the first section where you're referring to an individual, let's go back to your hypothetical case. You're in the village.
Right.
Young lady comes up and wants an abortion. Only one doctor in town. But he is whatever, and he just does not believe in performing abortions. Does he have that right to say no? But remember, he's the only doctor in town.
Yes.
And it's a poor person, have no access. What do you do in that case, Jerry?
If that physician's practice is supported with federal or state or public funds, then I would be concerned that this individual would establish a kind of practice that would allow him to eliminate immunizations if he felt that he didn't believe in it, would eliminate blood transfusions if they felt that that was not in the case. There are many things that could be eliminated, and if our state or federal or public funds are out there supporting that individual, I would have strong objections to that.
Senator Miller, I have to go back and agree with you. Every paragraph ends with the phrase, to end the life of an individual or involves an abortion. And that's what this bill addresses. And
he treats the elderly person before him, and he gets fell down some stairs, and he gets a Medicaid funding or whatever. He gets those federal dollars, state dollars. So therefore, he's under your definition. If he refuses to perform an abortion, although he has moral conscience against that, that overrides his moral conscience, according to the definition you just gave.
I would not expect an individual, if he felt strongly against that, to perform it. But I would expect that individual to make the information available to assist that individual in getting that. But in reality, what this bill does and what it intends to do is to eliminate access to that service in this state of Alaska, which then means that, again, goes back to those of us who can afford to go out and access these services for our dependents elsewhere, we can pay for that. But there are those poor who might have an equally valid reason for wanting that service who will not have access to that anymore.
Just to follow up, Madam Chairman, I think that the testimony maybe shows the reason why we should have the bill. When they're willing, the state is willing to enforce their moral convictions upon an individual who has maybe a different moral conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. No, I have no more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kristen Bumgen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kristen Bomingen. I am an attorney at the Department of Law. I supervise the Human Services section there. And amongst my client agencies is the Department of Health and Social Services. I apologize that probably my detailed analysis of this bill will not be in as great depth as it would have been otherwise were I commenting on the original bill, because a lot of my remarks were prepared to address the breadth.
I would just like to explain that we, after one this afternoon, didn't get this till well after one this afternoon ourselves, so, and we've had the heat on and it didn't happen, so.
Thank you. I can certainly understand the amount of heat that's on a number of issues right now. However, I do want to start my comments by saying that this is an excellent substitute for the previous version of the bill. The previous version had a great many references to broad moral convictions that would have caused no end of problems to health facilities in their hiring practices and in their attempts to deliver the services that health facilities even believed in being able to deliver. However, in my brief review of this, there still are some legal problems that remain, so I'll address those specifically. My first focus will be on 1817-040, which addresses the conscience of an institution. Now let's see, I'm sorry, I didn't look to see whether any change was made to the definition of a healthcare institution, but no, I see it still involves public institutions. Because the healthcare institution definition includes public institutions, this statute would grant to or pretend to grant to a public facility a right that actually violates the constitutional protections that are articulated in the Valley Hospital case. The Valley Hospital case very specifically said that a statute is not adequate to overrule a constitutionally protected right, so that this would not in any way affect.
Can I just interrupt right there?
Okay.
Is the constitutional amendment that's been introduced?
Deals with the Valley decision.
Is that dealing with this same issue? Yeah.
Dealing with the institution.
Is it viewed that they're companion bills, that you need a statute and
you
a
would,
constitutional
you, in my opinion, you would need the constitutional amendment in pass in order for the second section dealing with the individual or the institutional right.
In order for it to be constitutional.
To
so you're recognizing that already?
I do recognize.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to make sure I understood this right.
I can probably elaborate on that a little bit. This does create something that is separate in 040 that may address private institutions, though it would not necessarily do something that's any different than an option that might be asserted under the law as it stands today by a private institution that's not public funded by public dollars. Let me skim through my notes, if I may, since a lot of them deal with the breadth of the general moral conscience options that might have been invoked.
I think you're going to find much of that language is out.
I did go through it briefly, Madam Chair, and I did find that that doesn't appear to be here. This is the first time I've seen the specific language that's here regarding intending to end the life of an individual, and I haven't studied it yet to determine whether it still poses the problem that I was going to identify with relation to Medicaid funding for facilities. But let me just briefly touch on that so that you're all aware of the cautions that have to be exercised in this kind of an area. There is a federal requirement that all institutions that receive Medicaid or Medicare funds have to have a policy that informs admitted patients of their right to advance directives and their and that particular institution's policy regarding advance directives. So consequently, an institution may not wish to adopt a policy that will allow them to carry out an advance directive, but nonetheless, they are required by federal law to inform the person of their rights and not portray a partial picture to any patient that's being admitted. If there were some objection lodged by a board to even discussing this matter, which might be construed to be intended to end the life of a patient, and that board were to assert that as their policy, then the state would certification board would have to decertify the institution for Medicaid or Medicare payments. This statute, I believe, still provides a protection that says that a state agency cannot discriminate against an institution that would choose to do so, and so it presents a real conflict for the agency that I believe actually could endanger the entire Medicaid funding for the state, because as a state, we are required to be able to assure in our Medicaid plan that this advance directive information is provided to all patients when they're admitted. And so I still see this as a problem that remains in the language. Senator Mackey.
Yeah. What, as far as advance directive information, what exactly does that mean in terms of providing them information versus, my understanding is, and I apologize I was late to hear the explanation of the CS, but isn't this CS dealing directly with the ending someone's life or doing an actual abortion? Now, how does that relate to providing somebody with the information relating to either of those subjects or what it, could you explain what that advanced directive information means and whether or not that actually applies to this? It's one thing to provide information. It's another thing to actually perform a service or whatever.
Are you not talking about a living will or a...
Yes, I'm addressing living wills, do not resuscitate orders, and I believe there's some other pending legislation that is related to organ donations and the like that go to the kind of advanced directives that an individual can choose to make.
I guess I'm confused because you're saying that you have to provide that information. The bill speaks to specific services being provided. Are you suggesting that the Medicaid program would be in jeopardy if they didn't actually perform the service or if they didn't actually provide the information?
Through the chair to Senator Mackey, if they did not provide the information.
Okay, so they can provide the information but not perform the service.
It does not extend to requiring that all agencies provide the service.
Okay.
But it does extend to requiring that they inform. And the terminology that's used here is broad enough for an entity, an institution to be able to work within it to say, well, a service is to inform someone that they have the right to a living will. You know, people may have objections to admissions practices and the like, and they may have lodged that kind of a conscientious objection because it has to do with this terminology. Some sort of definition of this terminology would, at the minimum, be necessary to,
okay,
I think,
Kristen,
administer it in a way that would...
on page 3.
I just want to follow up. The...
I know, on 24, line 24. This, you're welcome to go ahead, but this lines 24 down to through 30 may...
are we on page 4?
On page 3.
3?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Posted notice.
Madam Chair, that is not adequate to meet the terms of the Medicaid policy. I do have it with me.
Okay. So are you saying, if I can, Madam Chair?
Sure.
If you're saying if they provide the information but they refuse to perform the service, that the Medicaid funding or other programs would not be in jeopardy?
Through the chair, I believe what you said, they are not required under Medicaid guidelines to perform the service.
Okay. But
they are
required
to
information.
Provide greatly detailed information to individuals who are admitted to their facilities about their rights to living wills, their rights to direct their own medical care, and a statement of the hospital or facility's policies regarding that right.
Okay, well, the question is it your opinion then that this bill does allow them to not provide the information?
Through the chair, Senator Mackey, I believe it could be interpreted to be applied that way.
Okay, then is that the intent of the legislation?
No, I'm sure it is not.
Okay, then that's something, I mean, the only reason I think that's an important point that needs to be clarified and not jeopardize Medicaid funding. And I think I understand what the intent of the bill is, but if there's some discrepancy there, that may need to be worked out.
Madam Chair, she's also going to get to why she had that opinion also, because it is an opinion.
Through the chair, Senator Ward, it's my opinion because the language has not been sufficiently clarified here. When I, taking this language cold as it appears in the bill, I could anticipate that if a board were to assert that policy of not wanting to notify, then it would in fact have a statutory defense to that policy that's articulated here, and so that at a minimum some amendment is needed to this bill to assure that this kind of construction of this law is not met.
And would you, you said that page 3, line 24 is irrelevant. Is that correct? And does nothing?
Through the chair, Senator Ward, no, I don't say it does nothing. It does not meet the term of the Medicaid and Medicare federal guidelines. So it fails to satisfy the need of this policy. This has to be presented to each patient.
And if it's, and if I may, Madam Chair, so you're saying that this notice with all of the facts in it up there is not giving them notice. Is that what you're saying?
Well, through the chair, Senator Ward, it does not meet the terms of the Medicaid requirements.
Can you read that in there, where, I mean, into the record where it doesn't? Maybe I didn't know how to read.
This refers to a posted notice. This is provide written information to each individual concerning the rights under state law to make decisions concerning their own medical care, including the right to accept or refuse medical surgical treatment and the right to formulate advanced directives. And the providers or organizations' written policies respecting the implementation of such rights, to document in the individual's medical record whether or not the individual has executed an advance directive.
And if it was the intent that the notice had all that written stuff on it and that it would be posted there and they would have to read it, and would that not accomplish exactly what you just said? I mean, it's not just going to be like a warning and a smoking sign, you know, $50 fine. It'll be a completely written policy.
Through the chair, Senator Ward, you may pose that as a solution here, but I'm not certain that it would meet the requirements of this, because you have people coming in under emergency circumstances or under any number of sets of circumstances. It's intended that they be provided with a written notice.
But that is a written notice if it's a written notice posted. I mean, that is a written notice. I mean, how do you get a notice that isn't written? It may be one word or 10,000 words, but it's still a notice, and it's in writing. I mean, I don't understand, just because it's on a wall as compared to in a folder, what's the difference? Maybe I don't understand. You have to tell me where it says that in there. You can't be on a wall. It has to be in a folder.
I will be happy to provide you with a copy of this. Each word of a statute is deemed to be meaningful in its presence in the statute. This says to provide written information to each such individual concerning this factor. And so I would stand on my interpretation that this really requires more than posting a sign in a corner or even in front of the admission desk that someone may or may not see regarding the hospital's policies on advance directives.
Oh,
Kristen, let me ask you a question. Is the point that you have to tell the person that they can have a living will and that there are advanced directive possibilities out there, is that also followed by the fact that you have to provide?
Madam Chair, no, you do not have to provide. You do not have to implement a living will. There's a specific exception that says that one does not, however, one cannot discriminate against an individual in the provision of other care based on their election to have a living will.
So we're not too far from what corrects it. We provide the information and then say, but by the way, we will not be implementing these orders.
It's maybe addressed in an exception or in a definition or in some clarification, but I think it's very vital that it be addressed in the zoning.
Because in my numerous hospital visits this last year, on every occasion when I entered, they asked if I had a living will, and that's as far as the conversation went. And I said, yes, and my husband will be here, and that was, there was no explanation. I mean, I didn't require an explanation, but I don't know if the answer is no, if that leads you down another path, but I'm not sure of that.
Madam Chair, my reading of the statute isn't necessarily indicative of where that would go if one answered no.
Mm-hmm. I know Jan will be here in a minute, and she can probably speak to that. Or,
Madam Chairman, I had one question, just to clarify my mind. I understand, you know, providing the information versus providing the service. Let's say we have three hospitals, two of them do it the way, you know, provide all the information, and you have one that elects not to for whatever reason. That doesn't mean that all three lose funding. It just means that one could be in jeopardy of the federal funding. I wasn't clear in what you were saying there.
Through the chair to Senator Miller, on its face, it would not necessarily mean that all three would, that all hospitals would lose funding. However, there's a contradictory provision. There's a provision in this law that poses a problem for the state agency in its representations in the Medicaid state plan to the federal health care financing agency. We have to assure the federal agency that we are complying with each of these elements that we're required to comply with, and that is to require an institution to provide this notice. Section C at the bottom of page 3 says that a person may not discriminate or retaliate against a healthcare institution in a grant, contract, or program because of the institution's refusal to counsel or advise or the rest. So this sets up a problem with our Medicaid program because the intention would be to decertify, to discriminate, really, based on the fact that they were not meeting these terms. And so if they could not discriminate on this basis, then we would no longer be able to assure the federal government that we were meeting the terms of their Medicaid program, and we would be deemed to be out of compliance with our state Medicaid plan. And
no.
That's what leads us to that problem.
Is that just because they haven't told the person it's available? But that a living will and do not resuscitate ours are out there?
Madam Chair, this is because our laws don't allow us to make distinctions between agencies that do and don't in the way we operate our programs. That would be the reason that it would run into that kind of a consequence.
And all of this is tied to federal funding of Medicaid.
Yes,
Medicare.
Madam Chairman, just going back to that, getting the way to correct that looks like to me, and I, you know, before we do it, I would want to think about it, but on page 4, line 1, if you strike the words counsel and advise, if you took that out of the sentence,
mm-hmm.
where they would have to give the counsel and advice, but they don't have to pay for or provide or perform or assist or participate directly.
Okay, then
does that meet some of your concerns?
I think we need to go back to
okay, yeah, but I mean, if
I pick up all of those.
Yeah, if you picked up all those, would those meet your concerns?
Through the chair, Senator Miller, I don't want to conclusively say yes without having an opportunity to study it, but that may be one of the ways, a definition may be one of the ways, some specific list in your exceptions, item in the exceptions list may be one of the ways. I haven't looked to see whether this would adequately do it yet.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll ask it a little differently. Are you willing to provide this committee with an opinion or a recommendation as to what it would take to make the program not be in jeopardy of losing Medicaid funds?
Through the chair, I believe I have. I mean, the three options are certainly there to be done. I don't know which one may be the best to achieve your purposes.
Okay. Madam Chair or Senator Miller, I don't know who can answer this, but in terms of, let's take Providence Catholic Hospital, for example. should Providence not wish to perform abortions, for obvious reasons, how does that work if, in the course of treatment to a woman, a doctor determines that an abortion may be one option that may be necessary to protect the life of that woman, or for whatever medical reason, which I'm definitely not a medical expert, would this legislation not allow them or give them an avenue to not suggest that that is one of the options that they would need, even though they say we don't provide the service, but an abortion may be a particular treatment that you may need to obtain to save a person's life? Or, you know, I mean, those kinds of issues, I think, really need to be well thought out, and not just whether or not they're going to lose any Medicaid funding, but as to what our policies say or that our institutions can or can't do. Because if they, because of moral reasons, and I'm Catholic, but I mean, for whatever reasons, their policies of the hospital are such that, you know, they would never suggest to somebody that they needed to have an abortion, and it potentially costs someone their life. Or, I mean, what is the view of the sponsor in terms of being able to still have that information or those kinds of counseling provided between a doctor and a patient? And staying away from the actual performing the service.
Sure.
Just so I can understand what this is doing.
First of all, I believe somebody here is here from Providence that could maybe address the Providence issue head on, because I certainly, you know, don't want to speak for them. But the first part of the bill, in my opinion, addresses the individual doctor that does not want to perform the service. In your hypothetical case, it certainly sounds like to me it's a doctor that is willing to provide, or certainly does not have a problem with giving that information because for whatever reason, they do not have a problem with abortion. But certainly the first part addresses those individuals that do have a problem with it. As how the hospital treats it, I think it may be a better question for Providence, since they are the largest health care provider actually in the state of Alaska. My concern is not making an institution that has a, or an individual that has, for whatever, you know, moral convictions especially, a problem with, you know, providing abortion, providing the actual service, providing the actual operation, or whatever you want to call it. I have a problem with that. I don't necessarily have a problem with providing literature as long as it's well-balanced literature, giving the other options to abortion also. You know, I believe that we have reasonable people out there. I believe we have a very educated public, and they can make those decisions. I have a problem with mandating person A, you have to perform it, or institution Y, you have to perform it.
And that's what current law in that Valley case is saying, that they have to provide it no matter what?
Well, I believe that the next law
will be
filed.
Because my understanding is there's only a few places in Alaska that actually offer abortion services.
I believe that you will start to see cases filed, and if you look at the Valley decision, I believe that Providence falls very well into the definition of quasi-public, although I'm not sure what that means, and nobody really can tell you what it means, whether it's public or private. What's this middle ground? But if you look at the definition they gave, you know, depending on what parts, there's either three or six parts of the test, because they used an old case, and then they came up with some new parts. All the new parts fits Providence, every one of them. And two of the old three parts fits Providence. The only one that doesn't fit Providence is not the sole hospital in Anchorage. But what happens when you go to Ketchikan and you have a public hospital, but it's run by a nun order that runs the Ketchikan Hospital? Or Fairbanks years ago, when it was the old St. Joseph's Hospital, which was the nuns that ran it, they didn't provide abortions. But I think you're going to see with the Valley case, in my opinion, you're going to see a number of cases filed, and I believe the next one that's going to be filed is against Providence Hospital. You got to take out the big. Once you've taken out the big one, the others fall like dominoes.
Senator Mackey, Valley Hospital is also on the line, and if you have any specific questions, you can address them to them as well when they come out.
Yeah, I'm not trying to belabor it here.
Sure,
I just
can.
I have a certain appreciation for what I think, you know, part of the intent is here with dealing with the person providing a service that they for their own religious or moral convictions. But what I would have a problem with doing is not providing pertinent medical information to a patient, or pertinent information, whether it's the living will aspect or abortion services. And I just wanted to state that, and hopefully in the end result that at a minimum that we make sure that that, as well as not jeopardizing any kind of Medicaid funding or anything else. So I'll just listen and see where.
Madam Chairman, I think it certainly, if as long as there's well-balanced information on both sides of the issue, let the person make the choice. I have no problem with that.
May I address some of the issues that were just discussed? In the first place, I'm not certain that it's appropriate to interpret our current law to say that individuals are forced into performing abortions under 1816.010. There is still a part of that statute that says that a person may not be required to perform an abortion. That's not been challenged, to my knowledge, at this point, and still stands as good law. Also, with regard to end-of-life issues, our statutes which address those concerns do specifically provide to allow a provider, a healthcare provider, to not pull the plug or not pull out the tube, and by their own conscience decide that's not what they would like to do and register. They have to inform the person, however, that they do not wish to follow that advance directive. And we have protections in the statute that will allow that to happen. So as far as individuals are concerned, it's my interpretation of the law that they are protected nonetheless. I think there are some inadvertent consequences that come out of this. If someone has a particular belief about these matters, and this was perhaps more relevant in the context of the conscience or moral belief, but I think it still can arise under this writing of this. If a person holds a particular belief that's against a minor having a child because they think it's wrong for a minor to have a child, they could just as well advise that minor in a slanted way in the other direction, in the direction of directing them to an abortion rather than to other alternatives in the healthcare field. And so I think that in writing this kind of legislation, people have to be careful when you get to what people can end up invoking as their reasons for not informing people of the full array of health care solutions that may be legitimately available to them. I think also there is a legal question about how the Valley Hospital case would apply to Providence Hospital. I can't say that I have a resolution to it, but that three-prong test involves first, in the Lutheran case, Lutheran v. Storrs, says that it has to be the only facility that's available to provide services. That construction funding has to have been provided by state and federal funding, and I believe that prong of the test also would not necessarily apply to Providence, and yet then there's a 25% issue. Okay. That comes up. And so I think it's not yet clear just how that test would apply.
Madam Chairman, what about the second three-prong test that was developed in this case? I think all three prongs of those apply.
They did apply to the Valley Hospital. That's
correct. Certainly would apply to Providence. Certificate of need, I'm just trying to find them, but that was one of them. That certainly applies to Valley Hospital. Or not Valley, but...
If I recall the figures correctly, I think that there's
a
relatively small portion of direct construction funding from state and federal resources.
Sitting on public lands, from my understanding, Providence Hospital, once it moved from downtown Anchorage, moved to public lands. I think that certainly fits into the category. So therefore, that certainly falls. I mean, you got to look at all the prong tests, and certainly the new prong test that they developed in the Valley decision, Providence fits all three of them. You can reach back to the Storrs case, and I believe it fits two of the three if you reach back that far.
Kristen? You know, we've kind of agreed that there's individually one criteria that everyone understands a little more than institutionally. If you had... which is probably nearly the case in Valley Hospital, staff members who are not interested and who do not want to participate in this, and if, for instance, you, everyone in the hospital refused, and that means they have to go out and hire on the basis of someone willing to perform an abortion because the institution is being required to perform abortions?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly certain how it gets applied and carried out. However, the hospital can, the facility cannot have a policy against providing them, and there would be a test applied to if, in fact, the effect of some of these protections were to make it impossible for someone to exercise their constitutional rights, then it is very possible there would be found some affirmative obligation for some entity to allow an individual to practice constitutional rights. I do not know how that would end up being applied or required.
Again, that is tied to the fact that that hospital receives federal dollars.
Well, the infringement of constitutional rights is really some, it's a state entity or a quasi-state or governmental entity that is prevented from taking any kind of an action that, that impedes someone's exercise of a privacy right.
Okay, so if I had a private hospital, I could say that no abortions would be offered in that building.
Yes, you could.
How many hospitals in the state are private?
Madam Chair, I don't have an answer for you.
You know, Dr. Nakamura? Lorraine?
Which ones of those qualify as private? Because they are quasi.
So essentially, I mean, and that's where we get to. See, I mean, because essentially we're saying for every hospital in Alaska, there is a specter of there being a requirement that abortions be offered and that their employees be required to do that.
Or at a minimum, that there be no policy that prevents that from happening where someone.
The record, Madam Chair, I'm Janet Oates, Director of Marketing and Government Relations for Providence Health System in Alaska. I think I'll answer some, although Senator Mackey isn't here, perhaps I'll go through my testimony first and maybe he'll return because I do have some responses to some of the questions. Basically, we did have a chance to review the substitute language of this bill just prior to the meeting. And we do express our support for SB 348 because accompanied by Senator Miller's proposed constitutional amendment, we do think it would resolve the issue raised by the Valley Hospital Supreme Court ruling. We really see this as an issue of choice, the ability or right for us as Providence or other hospitals to choose not to do abortions or other procedures in our facilities that don't conform to our religious and ethical values. And frankly, we really would hope that proponents of choice, if you apply those labels, would also respect our position and our choice not to do abortions. The proposed constitutional amendment and this bill ensure that this kind of mutual respect that I'm talking about would continue. It's the feeling of our attorneys from, I would say, conservative to liberal within our own organization, do feel that the Supreme Court decision identified a need for a conscience clause or something similar to that in the state constitution. Without such language, the court found that the state law, which currently allows hospitals freedom of choice, is unconstitutional as applied to quasi-public hospitals. Yet the definition, as we've heard, given of quasi-public hospitals is so broad that it could apply to every single hospital in the state of Alaska. The court, in essence, found that without a conscience clause, there could be a giant leap from a right to choose to be involved in abortion to a mandate to participate. And Providence originally had felt pretty confident that it would not apply to us, but as I said, our attorneys have looked at it, and I think some of the discussion earlier indicates our discomfort with this. And particularly in regard to the hospital in Kodiak and Seward, as you may know, we have taken over the management and operation of those facilities. We, in essence, leased buildings in Seward. The city gave money to build the building, and we are running their hospitals. So it does put us at risk. And as I understand the language of this bill, and I'm becoming more comfortable as I've reviewed it, and we've changed the language a little bit this afternoon, I think it's important because it provides the specific how-tos of how this will work, how an individual can express their position, their what their conscience is dictating, so that you don't get into a crisis situation where... And this goes back, I think, to the question that Senator Mackey has, what happens when the life of a mother is at risk? And we do have those situations at Providence. And that's the time where our ethics committee is called. It includes clergy, whoever, both our Catholic clergy, and if there's a clergy of any faith involved with family, their body and family members. We have corporate ethicists, the physicians. And those very tough decisions are made when a therapeutic abortion is necessary, when the life of the mother is at risk. So I think that has always been covered, and I think it will continue to be. In terms of the advanced directives, I think religious institutions embraced the advanced directives initiative in that federal mandate. We may not do a real good job of explaining it when you come to the hospital, but for our ethicists and our clergy, as they are dealing with families at the end of life, those advanced directives are very helpful. And I think the difference between the advanced directives and this discussion on page 4, line 24, I think the difference is indicated here. In this paragraph, procedure means a medical procedure intended to end the life of an individual or involving an abortion. There's a difference in intent in the advanced directive. We talk about the removal of life support, which is artificial life support, and then the natural ending of life. So I think that would not interfere with the federal mandate to provide information about advanced directives. And actually, at Providence, our clergy, I think, would say more often than not, we're trying to follow the advanced directives, and it's a child that hasn't seen a parent for years and is feeling so guilty. They're the ones not wanting us to follow advanced directives. So I guess, in conclusion, I would say we're comfortable with the direction this is going, and I think it gets clearer, and we feel it's a good companion piece to the constitutional amendment.
Any questions from Ms. Oates?
I have one.
Yes, Jerry.
And I didn't know. No. Is all of Providence under public land?
That was a new one for me.
It was me too.
I read that I found out. Actually, in discussion with one of the attorneys that is very involved in the case, he was the one that was in public land when they moved from the downtown side.
Or else it was a pretty good deal of some sort.
Good.
Yeah.
I did not know that until I found out.
Senator Duncan.
Senator, I'm remembering your first statement, though, when you started the testimony. I just want to be sure I'm clear on it. You said that you believe this bill deals with abortions or other procedures that do not comply with our religious and ethical values, or other procedures. So what did that mean? What does that mean?
Well, that's kind of been following the language of the various. I've been testifying at different versions. I think in this, what we have thought, euthanasia was one that we were considering in some of the language of some of the earlier variations of the constitutional amendment. We've gone back and forth between our attorneys and our ethicists whether the broad sweep is better or specific, and I think most people are comfortable with the result we have now on the constitutional amendment, specifically identifying abortions, and this one to the end of life, which I would
call... Your first statement was incorrect, then. This does not say abortions or other procedures in your mind.
Which...
The committee substitute.
Yes, I think it does.
Or other procedures.
No, it's talking specifically ending the life or involving an abortion.
Okay, and so my question was, I just was confused from your testimony, because you start off by saying that it talks about abortions or other procedures, so which
yeah.
kind of Dr. Nakamura was talking about, and I wanted to be sure I understand whether this bill talks about abortions, or does it talk about, in your mind, abortions or other procedures. You're the hospital that will do the interpretation, and I want to know whether, in your mind, you interpret now as meaning other procedures, such as immunizations or such
no,
as...
No, no way. So if I can correct my earlier testimony, I would say choose not to do abortions or end the life of an individual, if I may correct my testimony.
Thank you, Janet.
Or end the life of an individual, with the exception of if it's a case of where the life, if the abortion needs to be performed to save the life of an individual.
During this session, I wished I'd either gone to seminary or law school, but...
after your review committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it is, yeah. I mean...
It's very tough. It's very tough.
But what does it mean to you? It is very tough. But what does it mean to you, representing Providence? What would this bill mean to you if there is the...
It would be involving an elective abortion. Perhaps that would clarify it a little bit more, not where the life of the mother is at risk.
Janet, would it not be that you could continue operating like you are right now?
Yes.
With maintaining your
mm-hmm.
current
mm-hmm.
status and reputation for the services you offer?
Right.
So your interpretation is this applies to elective abortions only?
Yes. Yes.
I guess I'd like to ask Department of Law to see if that's what this says.
She just asked when she comes back here, we'll pose that question to her.
Right.
Thank you.
That's what you're comfortable with.
Yeah. Okay, in Mattsu we have Dr. Gerald Phillips. Would you like to go ahead and begin your testimony?
Yes, I'm Dr. Gerald Phillips. I'm a physician out here I'm a radiologist specifically, and I do diagnostic imaging. So I would like to speak for this bill. One of our means of imaging out here is the services we provide is ultrasound, and ultrasound is very good for evaluation of fetal development throughout the pregnancy. The measurements can give size and dates of the pregnancy, and it can also tell abnormalities. Both the radiologist and the ultrasound technician is involved in the performance and the interpretation of the ultrasound exams. I would like to relate two types of situations. The first of these is that we, the technologist as well as the radiologist, become involved at times with pre-abortion evaluations. And we're asked for the size and dates in those planning an abortion. Now, I don't know how often this occurs because they, meaning the referring health provider or physician, may not say this is a pre-abortion evaluation. However, you can feel and often know at times that the information you are giving, and others that we are giving by dating the fetus by this ultrasound, below a certain age is like signing its death warrant. Specifically, if a fetus below a certain age is smaller and therefore it's easier to abort, it's less traumatic to the mother, and it's easier to do earlier. So in this situation, you feel like an accomplice. Understand that history doesn't say pre-abortion evaluation. We don't always know that. A second situation that's more grave, and certainly this is infrequent, but I think would apply to this case, is that on three occasions, one of my techs and I have been involved or called to do ultrasound for a patient with the history. The history that was given was that a lady is pregnant and she is bleeding. What was actually occurring, unknown to us at the time, is that the ladies in question here were bleeding because they were partway through an abortion, and they didn't have all the pieces accounted for. Each instance, we found retained fetal head or skull not yet removed. Not knowing an abortion was in progress it initially looked like a marked malformation to us. My tech and I felt taken in and outright lied to. It is like showing up at a murder scene and being asked by the perpetrator to help clean up or remove the remaining evidence, and you aren't in a position or can't refuse. This is a haunting feeling to be part of something that results in the elimination of life. It is emotional, and in medicine, you are here to help, or the reason we go into medicine is to help, and at times you wonder what you have done. I had one tech who would, for days after this, become shaken, cry, and need to take a break outside, as she would now be doing studies on other early pregnancies. I have lost, and our hospital and community have lost, at least two excellent ultrasound technicians because of having these types of involvement. They quit and have left, as this was so contrary to their values. And so I'll stop with that. But those are the two cases that situations that we see apply to this.
Thank you, Dr. Phillips, for coming out this afternoon to testify. Dr. William Reisinger, are you there?
Yes, Senator Green, I'm here. I'm Dr. William Reisinger, and I'm a radiologist, a physician also at Valley Hospital. I was glad that Dr. Phillips spoke ahead of me because he could relate some of the specific effects of abortion and the involvement that we might be forced into. And fortunately, I have not had that experience. I hope that I will not. I would like to share some of the philosophic basis of why Dr. Phillips and I would be strongly opposed to abortion and involvement in it. We've already spoken of religious and faith issues, and scriptural issues have been perhaps alluded to, but let me focus on one thing that happened to, I hope, most, if not all of us when we graduated from medical school. I graduated back in 1969, and I took the Hippocratic Oath at that time. Most of us did. Perhaps even Dr. Nakamura did when he graduated. And as we know, the Hippocratic Oath forbids euthanasia and abortion, very specifically. It's a 2,400-year-old tradition, and it has nothing to do with state money or federal money or anything else except a tradition in medicine to do the highest and best for our patients. It is not the only reason that I do not support abortion, but certainly a strong one. I've heard that said that you cannot legislate morality, but I say you cannot legislate without morality. And just because something is legal does not necessarily mean it's moral. I believe that there are laws of God that are higher than laws of men. And I also believe that unelected activist judges or Supreme Court justices do not have the right to supervene and come in to a physician in his personal practice of medicine and his upholding of his own Hippocratic Oath. So I believe that this issue comes to some very basic values, that a physician has a right to have conscience and follow moral values and certainly abide by his Hippocratic Oath. It's also a tradition in America that we've had freedom of conscience in the past, where even groups like the Quakers have not necessarily participated in war, but have been noncombatants or conscientious objectors. And so, again, I support this bill, and I support the constitutional amendment because I think they address this type of issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reisinger. Cliff Orm.
My name is Cliff Orm. I'm the administrator of Valley Hospital. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee. And the thing I wanted to say today, add to the testimony that has been given. I concur with what has been said by Janet Oates of Providence, also with the testimony offered by the radiologist at Valley Hospital. We are hopeful that this legislation will offer more choice to the providers who choose not to be a part of controversial procedures. The other thing I'd like to say is that when we talk of the impact of either the constitutional amendment or this bill being to eliminate the service being provided in Alaska and discriminating against the poor, in particular, who cannot afford to leave the state to receive the procedure, I must remind people that the hospital is not the only place to receive an abortion, that only second and third trimester abortions generally are performed in hospitals. At least that's the case in our community, that first trimester abortions are available outside of a hospital setting in a private physician office. It's only when the fetus has developed to a stage as defined by statute that would require the sterile rooms that actually a hospital is needed, or not even a hospital, a facility that meets the criteria as defined. And so to say that an abortion would not be available should something like this bill pass or a constitutional amendment would be incorrect. And but I just want to make that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you, Cliff. Appreciate you all coming out today to testify on this. And in Kodiak is Diana Buffington. Is Kodiak still online?
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Diana Buffington. I'm the Republican District Chair out here in Kodiak. I am for this bill. I do, and with the greatest respect to Providence Hospital, I have recently had surgery at Providence Hospital. Providence Hospital, when I signed in or pre-admitted, they asked me if I had a living will in place, and I discussed this with the lady. I have no doubt in my mind that my beliefs and my moral convictions of not being kept on resuscitation or machines or resuscitated beyond all hope, you know, after my physical body is beyond all hope, I feel that they would live up to my living will because they do have a copy of this will. I do not believe that this bill has anything to do with a living will. It has nothing to do with therapeutic abortions. I had a therapeutic abortion 2.5 months prior to Roe v. Wade being granted under the U.S. Supreme Court and under the law that we currently have. And that therapeutic abortion was provided to me at a Catholic hospital. We did have about a week to 2 weeks to firmly decide and go through the process of deciding about an abortion. This bill is to prevent doctors or hospitals or clinics who do not agree with the abortion issue, who do not agree with the euthanasia issue, that they would have the right to not counsel or advise or recommend those procedures simply because it's an effective way to end a pregnancy, or it is an effective way of not putting a person through what they feel may be unfathomable pain or existence. I do not believe that we should keep our doctors from performing procedures they feel are safe and necessary for the commitment of life, to the commitment of life, and neither should our institutions be forced to counsel and advise when their board of directors or their shareholders, whether they be a private hospital, a public hospital, with Medicaid funds, without Medicaid funds, or whatever funds they go, they should, people are elected to the boards. They have ethicists, like Providence Hospital said, that determine what the grounds and determinations should be made by medical doctors. I can see also where this may, you know, in the future may affect cloning or the transplant of cloned tissues or organs from a clone. We have a lot of issues that are coming up and have been coming up for quite a few years, and to have a unelected judge or Supreme Court or anyone mandate that hospitals or doctors who receive Medicaid or Medicare funds, or hospitals that, whether they're sitting on public land or private land, federal land, native land, or any type of land, that's built with state funds, private funds, combinations of thereof. We should not have to determine what the process they will, each institution or each doctor feels is his moral obligation, whether it's by the Hippocratic Oath or the mission statement and philosophy of the institution. I ask that you vote for this this bill in the affirmative and give each individual the right to determine what they feel are their moral ethics for whatever treatment they see fit. Thank you.
Thank you, Diana. We'll hold SB 348 until next week, and we'll review it and check on some of the legal things that we need to check on. And if the folks who had objections, we'll get their objections in writing or your concerns. And if you have any solutions, I'd appreciate those as well. And Lorraine, can you get me an answer on the number of hospitals out there? Yeah, I'd be. I'd like to know what they are. Okay, thank you. I saw Annette. Okay. HB 449. Okay, next on the agenda is House Bill 449, which is thankfully very brief.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, legislative aide to Representative Gene Terrio, sponsor of the of House Bill 449. And I'd like to begin just with the sponsor statement. This is a short and quick piece. Under the Alaska Exemptions Act, retirement plans are protected from creditor claims. However, it does so by listing each type of retirement plan by reference to the Internal Revenue Code section that governs that plan. HB 449 will expand the current list to include the newly created Roth IRA. The 1997 Taxpayer Relief Act passed by Congress created the Roth IRA account under Internal Revenue Code section 408A. Contributions and earnings from traditional IRAs can be rolled over into a new Roth IRA. However, when the rollover is done, the taxes must be paid on the capital gains that are realized. To soften this potential tax bite, Congress has allowed all of the taxable income stemming from rollovers done in 1998 to be spread over a four-year period rather than one. This is a great opportunity to convert all future IRA account earnings into tax-free income and spread the current tax bite over 4 years. However, those Alaskans who take advantage of this are removing their assets from the list of those protected under state law. This option is available only during 1998. Beginning in 99, distributions from regular IRA accounts that are rolled into Roth IRAs will be fully taxed in the year of the rollover. In order for Alaskans to maintain their protection while taking advantage of this opportunity, legislation must be passed this session.
Questions? Other questions?
Madam Chair, is it your intent to move the bill?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to move HB 449 under the recommendation.
And I don't think there's anyone else to testify.
Sure.
That HB 449 is moved on to its next committee of referral, which is Labor and Commerce, and it's Rural Fiscal Health. Thank you, Senator Magley.
Good job, young man.
Okay. We'll take it out of use until Annette Craig or our Senator Lehman. The hearing on Senate Bill 287, an act relating to parole consideration. And the sponsor staff is here. Could you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am Annette Kreitzer, staff to Senator Lauren Lehman, who is the sponsor of this legislation. I'm trying to get rid of non-road engines and deal with parole considerations. In 1994, the legislature passed and the voters approved a constitutional amendment that strengthened the rights of victims of crimes. Among the rights enumerated is the right of a victim to be present at parole hearings. Senate Bill 287 addresses the emotional trauma for victims when an inmate eligible for parole waives that parole hearing and essentially ends up on an automatic schedule of reappearances before the parole board. The sponsor acknowledges, along with representatives from the parole board, But it's not a common situation. It's I would say probably even a rare situation, but it does occur and it does traumatize the victims who are notified and then get re-notified that the hearing is called off or the parole hearing is called off. So what the bill seeks to do is to try to tighten up that situation. It doesn't mean that someone who might be have a lot of time to think about how to beat the system couldn't beat the system even under this bill, but it does tighten up the loophole now and put the inmate on the schedule of the parole board. It provides if an inmate waives their right to a hearing that they are put on a six-month schedule to come back before the board and so that they are on the board's schedule and not their own personal decision about when to reappear before the parole board. There is a committee substitute, Madam Chairman, a proposed committee substitute that the sponsor had drawn up after we've had some discussions with the parole board, and it has to do with the way the bill was worded initially. I'm not sure if you have that.
Is it version A?
Actually, Madam Chairman, I don't even have it. I think it must be version A. There is only one.
CS, only one CS. Okay.
Yeah.
I'd move to adopt the CS, Madam Chair, for discussion.
Purpose of discussion, version E, lookup is before us.
The committee, the proposed committee substitute seeks to make plain, rather than before the issuance of the board's decision, we're actually talking about the hearing. So we're saying before the hearing on a prisoner's application for discretionary parole, we're just making it very plain what this subsection would apply to. It would apply to a hearing on a prisoner's application for discretionary parole. And then the other change is at the bottom, line 14. If a prisoner who has applied for discretionary parole fails to appear for a scheduled hearing when requested to appear, the board shall consider the prisoner's application as being withdrawn under this subsection. And you'll notice underneath that it says one of the regulation 22AC 2150K is annulled. This language, if a prisoner who's applied for puts into statute that portion of, we agree with the Board of, with the Department of Corrections that we need to provide for this situation when a prisoner fails to appear that they in fact do waive their right or that their application is being withdrawn under the subsection. That was contained in the regulation that we seek to annul under the committee substitute. The rest of the regulation actually isn't, it should be annulled. It's not very clear about waiving. They use the term in the regulation, the term applicant is used when in fact we're talking about prisoners. So the word applicant in regulation, it means that the person has already applied. So nothing here prohibits the department from coming back in the future and writing a new regulation that's clearer by annulling 150K and incorporating a portion of that into statute, which we agree with the Department of Corrections should be in statute, providing for that prisoner who has applied for discretionary parole to that application is being is considered to have been withdrawn. We agree with that. But the other portion of that regulation is what has contributed to the problem that we're seeking to correct.
Yeah, why do we have to have a bill to do this? Did Senator Lehman talk to the Department of Corrections? Are they willing to take a, or do they recognize the problem with the regulation?
To the Chair, Senator Mackey, the problem, I guess it has to do with your confidence level in someone addressing it through regulation. It's a small problem. It's not something that the department may want to take up in regulation, and you can bring that question up to the department. But we have been in discussion with Department of Corrections.
Well, I just have a problem with trying to legislate regulations, and I guess another word is micromanage. But, I mean, if there's a problem with regulation, it seems like we ought to be able to, I mean, this makes sense, I guess.
What happens if somebody is sick and they don't make their parole hearing? Or the transport trooper didn't get them there on time for their hearing or whatever, they automatically rejected? Doesn't say anything in here about those kinds of I could see if somebody just doesn't show up. You know, maybe we ought to not provide them, you know, the expense or whatever to have these parole hearings and get them on the docket if they're not going to show up or if they consistently do that. But it seems to me that could be handled through regulation or at least provide some exception if somebody has a halfway decent excuse. Has that been looked at all?
Mr. Senator Mackey, yes, we've had numerous discussions about various scenarios of what happens with a prisoner who's up for parole. And when you're saying that you don't want to micromanage, the first section of this does not necessarily micromanage, except that it takes the prisoner off of his own schedule and puts him on a schedule established by the Board of Parole. That's just a policy decision, whether the legislature agrees with that or not. The annulment of the regulation is just to make plain that this is the policy that the legislature would prefer, that in discretionary parole, that the board, at the request of the prisoner, may withdraw, and it says may withdraw consideration of prisoner's application for discretionary parole.
And they can't do that now?
They can do that now. They can do that portion of it now.
Okay. Madam Chair, are they not doing it now?
It's in rare cases. We're admitting, and we've admitted freely to the Department of Corrections, that we recognize that this is not a pervasive problem, but it is a problem for the victims. When hearings are canceled at short notice, and the victim continues to be notified month after month that there is going to be a hearing. Oh, no, there's not. Oh, yes, there is going to be a hearing. So if there's some sort of schedule, it's not to say that after the six-month period that the prisoner might not show up and waive his right to show up at the hearing. It's an attempt to just tighten up what isn't a very common occurrence, but which is something that makes it harder for victims of crime to have to deal with when they're going through this process of the victim notification.
Senator Mackey.
Yeah, just can the department do this by regulation now?
What do we ask the department?
Well,
through
the chair, Senator Mackey, my understanding is if they wanted to do this through regulation, that they could do this through regulation.
Okay, and then my next question is, has anybody asked them to do it through regulation?
Senator Mackey, through the chair, not prior to the introduction of the legislation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I haven't. I should clarify that. I can't speak for everybody else in the world, but I have not asked them.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to ask them the same question.
Yeah,
Michael Stark?
This must be on a priority list somewhere.
You're the corrections guy. Even you didn't touch this one.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Stark. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I've served as counsel to the Department of Corrections and to the Parole Board. And the Department and Parole Board both asked me to appear today. The Parole Board is out at hearings, so the staff, including the Executive Director, is not available locally, so they've asked me to appear. Both the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board are sensitive to the needs of victims and try to accommodate those whenever possible. Given that, the board and the department don't believe that this bill is necessary, that it addresses a problem that doesn't exist. And I may be one of the few lawyers that you'll talk to who feels like fewer laws are better than more laws. And if there's not a problem that needs to be fixed, I suggest that the legislature shouldn't try to fix it. The incident that occurred, which was the catalyst for this bill, was one individual who had applied for parole, who shortly before the scheduled hearing withdrew his application because he wanted to get an independent psychiatric examination. So he had a legitimate basis for asking the board to postpone his hearing and his consideration for parole so that he could show that, I guess, that he hoped that a psychiatric exam would improve his chances for parole. And there was a scheduled hearing, and that was taken off, and the victim was notified, and apparently the victim was unhappy about that incident. This bill is not going to fix that problem. What this bill will do will make that prisoner ineligible to apply for parole for another six-month period. But at the end of that period, when the guy applies again, if something comes up or whatever may motivate the applicant, if he decides to withdraw his application again, at the last minute, if that were to happen, the victim again would have to be called off and told that the hearing is not going to take place. Not only is this not a prominent problem, it's not a problem at all. I'm not aware of any other situation where this ever occurred, and this wasn't done as by the prisoner in an effort to jerk the victim around at all. There was a legitimate reason for withdrawing the application at that time so the person could get a psychiatric exam. So
Michael, let me ask you a question. Currently, if you had someone scheduled for a hearing and the person canceled it, the prisoner canceled it for whatever reason, how soon after that could he have a subsequent hearing?
The parole board meets quarterly on discretionary parole applications. Every 3 months they meet. And the regulations require that a prisoner submit an application at least 7 weeks before the next scheduled hearing in order to be considered. If it's later than that seven-week period, they won't be heard until the next set of hearings after that three-month period. And if I could anticipate Senator Mackey's question that he asked, I don't believe that the board, without statutory authority, can say that a person won't be heard for six more months. I think under existing statute, they probably have a right to be considered at the next hearing if they meet the requirement in submitting their application at least 7 weeks in advance. As a practical matter, it's going to be at least 3 months, and it may well be 6 months if they don't meet that seven-week deadline for submitting an application. This has not, as I said, this hasn't occurred. This has not been a problem. It's unfortunate that that the victim in that instance, had made plans to be there and at the last minute was told the hearing was called off, and I'm sure that was inconvenient, but it's just not a problem that normally occurs.
Yeah. Other questions?
Sure. Let me give a try at it.
Okay. Senator Ward.
Yeah.
Okay. So really what this legislation is doing, it is reacting to a victim that was traumatized by a criminal and saying that we would like to have some kind of order to your discretionary withdrawals of the applications for parole. And so what the victim in this case has requested of the senator is, yes, if in fact you have a situation where you yourself have withdrawn the application to be considered for parole, that it be six more months before you can apply again. That's the basis of what this bill is doing.
That's my understanding.
And what harm do you see in that?
I don't see any egregious harm with the adoption of this bill. I want to make that clear.
Okay, then if there is no harm to it, and in fact that would make victims, in this case the ones that have been damaged by these criminals, it would make them even remotely more comfortable to know that there was a procedure in place, then would that not be, at least in the parole board's opinion, a good public policy? Or do they not consider the victim into the scenario?
Oh, no, they are very concerned about victims and any inconvenience that might be imposed on them. We don't believe this bill addresses that, though.
And
six more months when the guy comes back up, if he resubmits his application, the very same thing could occur.
However, if I understand, and I do understand what a lot of people that do go through this process, an extra 90 days would cause people to give thought and process to not adhering to a prescribed program, if at all possible. Anybody that's down for an extra 3 months is going to pay attention if they might be able to get out.
Well, the reason that this individual withdrew his application is because he thought his chances for getting parole would actually be increased by withdrawing and waiting till they had the psychiatric examination available.
And did this person have this opinion and put it in writing requesting the psychiatric examination before his withdrawal or after? This is very important. I'm familiar with this particular one, I believe.
And through the chair, I'm sorry, could you...
Did he apply to go have a psychiatric exam before he withdrew his application?
I don't know whether he arranged for the psychiatric examination before or after he notified the board that he wanted to withdraw his application.
I'm sure.
Senator Duncan.
I'd like to move the bill from committee.
Yeah, he's good.
We haven't had all our testimony yet, Senator Duncan, but I certainly appreciate the motion.
I mean, this is such an important piece of legislation. I do think we got to get it moving, and I know that we all have important things to do, and
okay.
I mean, let's keep these priorities going. So I put the motion on the floor to move the bill from committee.
Object.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to have to vote for that one, I think.
To move it out of committee?
Oh, you want to keep it here?
No, I don't want to get more witnesses because the parole board needs to be here and the Victims for Justice.
You don't want to move, Senator Lehman?
I have my methods too.
Can I just ask one question before
we
need a vote on that motion? I haven't withdrawn it.
Well, we're still discussing it.
Can I speak to the motion then?
Speak to the motion, Senator Mackey.
What happens if somebody got sick that day or if they didn't? I mean, believe me, I'm not trying to defend criminals or anything else, but I mean, if for a legitimate, you know.
I tried to make the motion so that
I'm going to come around to that.
You're going
to
leave.
No, I'm not going to.
What happens if you don't leave Lauren?
No way.
But in this bill, I mean, do they have any discretion at all? I mean, if somebody doesn't show because they're sick or they get a flat on the prisoner transport truck or whatever and they don't show up, do they not get another chance for 6 months?
Madam Chair.
If I was like hanging in there waiting for my hearing and that happened to me.
The parole board conducts hearings at the facility that the inmate is applying for parole. So there is no transportation problem. And if there's a legitimate reason such as illness, of course the board would exercise its discretion and simply reschedule the hearing.
But they can under this bill, right?
They can.
Where?
That part of the bill actually comes from the existing regulation that's being annulled. It simply moves it from the regulation to statute. And they already have that under their regulation. They do exercise discretion in that kind of situation.
Thank you very much. We need to roll call on the
Is this your intention to hold the bill over? Is that why you don't want to take the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's just as good. You get out of here that fast.
Well, and since we're holding it over for a committee substitute,
the committee substitute's right here.
We're going to have a new one, maybe. A new one, maybe.
The motion is before us. If you call the roll, please.
Senator Ward?
No.
Senator Mackey?
Yeah, you already got me on.
Yes.
Senator Duncan?
Yes.
Chairman Green?
No.
Can I change my vote to no? I change my vote to no. Chairman Green at me.
Thank you for your
support. Jim's having too much fun.
He is, I tell you. He's statewide candidates, really good.